Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it is, I believe, August the 23rd, and welcome to the Q&A call. 2010, by the way, since these things will go on for a long time, I believe. So today we have several questions. Except I just covered up all of my questions when I went into talk. So give me one moment. We'll get back to our questions here. Apologize. And I'm actually going to let Aaron, who's in town today, read our questions for us. So, Aaron, you can read the first question if you would like.
So the first question is, when does it hurt spouse's forgiveness, waiting for the unfaithful to get it, and being understanding, stop being Christ-like and wise, and become foolish, destructive, or about letting evil in? Can you give examples of scripture that can build confidence and help the hurt spouse come to terms with how they meet, how it may be the most loving / Christ-like response to let go and end the marriage?
So the first, since this is a specific question, the first scripture that comes to mind is Luke chapter, Luke chapter 17, where Jesus says, if your brother sins, rebuke him. If he repents, forgiven. If he sins seven times a day and seven times repents, forgiven. So to me, a lot of it has to do with the other person's heart. That, you know, when there's a hardness of heart, I don't think there's a lot of wisdom in continuing to allow someone to be in a pattern of behavior that's really destructive to them. And so in that sense, I mean, I would call that ultimately enabling. Now, if someone continues to try to work recovery and genuinely it's a, you know, there's a softness, there's always an incredible brokenness or a brokenness and repentance, then I think that there's reasons to continue because of Luke 17 to hang in there. But if there's no brokenness and if there's no repentance, I don't know that we're called to stay in relationships where there's infidelity on an ongoing basis like that. So I guess my primary criteria is kind of a hardness of heart. Also, when people, I think, when you see them broken, it's like there's a continuing willingness to try to get it, to try to move forward, to try to change, to try to turn back to God, whatever. So I think that's important. There's a book by David Einstein Brewer called Divorce and Remarriage in the Church, and it actually does a very good job, I think, of going through all the scriptures on marriage and divorce. And so if that's something you're considering, you might want to look at some of the some of his writings. I think you would find that enlightening. Again, I don't know that we're called to stay in a relationship where there's chronic, I guess, betrayal in a sense. I mean, if you think about it in the long run, God is a divorcee. I mean, ultimately, God divorced the nation of Israel because of their hardness of heart and their unwillingness to continue to turn back. And so I hope that helps a little bit. I don't think that you wait forever. I think you set a date in the future, in my opinion, for, you know, kind of allowing God time to work in that other person's life and to alter them. But if ultimately that doesn't come about, then I think through prayer, as long as you feel that release from God, then it's time to move on. Spiritual roadblocks.
What are ways to better feel God in your life, to increase your faith and prayer life?
So, you know, to me, spending time with God is probably the best way to do that. I think just having creating space in your life for you to have time with God, communion with God. And I'm not just talking Sunday mornings or Wednesday nights when you go to Bible study, but really to me it's about a relationship, and it's about an ongoing conversation. It's about, you know, trying to experience Him and be focused on Him. And I think that's an intentional act, and it's not something that and it's not something we do out of obligation. It's something we do just because we can grow to learn to, I think, really enjoy Him. I mean, that to me is probably the best way that I bring glory to God, is just simply by enjoying Him. And, you know, I do that when we drive the car together and talk each day. I do that as I bring Him into activities, as I become aware. It's not that I'm bringing Him in. He's already in. I just have to become aware of His presence. And to me, as I, you know, say, it's about participating with Him. But it is finding times to spend with Him. This morning, coming in, one of the ways I did it was I was listening to the book of John when I was in the car. And, you know, just listening to His words and, you know, enjoying, you know, John chapter 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and the whole pool of Bethesda. And, you know, I was thinking, that question came up, you know, do you want to be healed? And I was kind of just conversing, just talking to the Lord about that. And, you know, thinking, you know, Lord, how many of us really want to be healed? I mean, and it's funny, even that guy, when he answered, kind of made an excuse, you know, well, I don't ever have a chance. And it was interesting, because even in that verse, in John 5, Jesus said, take up your mat and walk. And it was almost like the guy had to take an action. And I'm just thinking, how does that apply to us as people? And then I was talking to the Lord about that. I think that that's one way. Another way is there are some books you can read, I think, that really help with that. I've always enjoyed Brother Lawrence's book, Frank Wabach, Coming Home to Your True Self. There's several books like that that I think really help you begin to sense His presence and just practicing His presence. Abba Father by Brennan Manning is another book I think that's good. So those would be some of my suggestions. Next question, Ms. Sarah.
My best friend from college just got married. I asked her how it was going, and she said, well, because it's you, I'll be honest. It sucks. Do most newly married people feel so disappointed and like they maybe married a wrong person? Is there ever the wrong person? I admit that my second husband, even though unfaithful, is a much better match for me personality-wise than my first husband, who was faithful, but his personality with mine was much less compatible to me. Any words of wisdom for her before she ends up joining ARC?
You know, I've always... There are people for us to be married to that I think could be much easier probably than the person that we are married to. But just because someone might be easier to be married to doesn't necessarily make them a better person to be married to. I know that I think God brings me the perfect circumstances in my life to help me draw near. If I had the perfect mate, I don't know that I'd do nearly as well. And Steph's almost perfect. I'm going to be careful here now. But if Steph and I didn't have conflicts, and if we weren't different, and if we were just alike, I don't know that I'd be nearly as close to God as I am. I mean, it's iron sharpens iron. And so I'd be curious about your friend if she looks at compatibility as the measure of how well things end up working out. You know, maybe they're not compatible or they don't agree. But you've got to remember, in any given marriage, two-thirds of all problems are unsolvable from the get-go. So that being the case, really great marriages aren't about how well or how compatible you are with someone, but it's how well the two of you live around the issues you can agree with and still show love and still show respect. And those are skills that I think almost anybody can learn. That I think there are a few circumstances that can be really difficult, again, not knowing exactly what would make him the wrong person, if you're not, for instance, sexually attracted to someone prior to marriage and you marry them. that might be a difficult situation, but still not impossible. And maybe there's a lot to learn from that. So I think it depends on ultimately what your goal is in marriage. And if it's happiness, then probably any marriage is going to end up being a disappointment. But if it's maturity and if it's, you know, to draw near to God, you know, she may have the perfect marriage. Some people do match better. But like I said, I don't know that that is better. Next question.
Okay. Sex addiction. Can you help me understand how it works for a sex addict who does not act out because of the pleasure, but to numb bad feelings or relieve trauma? How does sex work to numb bad feelings if it doesn't even feel good for the addict? Or how does it relieve trauma? Why can't it make this happen?
So one of the chemically, what happens when someone acts out is one of the neurochemicals released are endorphins. And endorphins ultimately are a derivative of morphine. Or morphine's a derivative of endorphins, I guess. Actually, the real thing is what's in our brain, which is the endorphins. So they're an opiate by nature. They numb out. And so when somebody is acting out frequently, it's a great way to kill pain. I mean, when I'm a Vicodin addict, they have to take the Vicodin just to feel normal. And it's not just a physical numbing. It's an emotional numbing. So for a lot of people, their sexual addiction, or even alcoholics, will do much of the same thing. What it does is it takes away the pressure or the edge in life so that they can, in their own mind, kind of face reality better because it doesn't hurt as much. In reality, if you think about it, though, I was talking to somebody about a Vicodin addict this morning. They're all wusses. We're wusses as addicts. I mean, it's like we're scared to actually face the pain and to walk through the pain. And I just think that at one level, we've got to accept the fact that sometimes life is really hard. And God does grant us the ability to, I think, walk in difficult situations, but He doesn't give us more than we can bear or handle.
So, the next one is sex and orgasms. You mentioned once that there are multiple different ways for women to have orgasms. What are they? And also, what does it mean if you can only have an orgasm one way? Besides frustrating, is it related to being able to surrender during sex? The next one is from the same person and related. Is there a healthy or normal way for most women? Is there a healthy or normal way that most women have orgasms? I was sexually touched as a young girl, and I noticed 99% of the time the only position I can have an orgasm in is the same position in which I was first introduced to orgasms as a very young girl. I think that's probably what she means in the first question. She says, what does it mean if you can only have an orgasm one way?
So most women can only have an orgasm one way, and in that sense, I don't know that that's unusual. I don't know how much I want to get into different ways women can have orgasms. There's a book, though, if you want to read it, that covers all of that. So I'll probably refer you to the book rather than put this one online, since we potentially have sex addicts here that could listen to the call. But the science of orgasm is a fascinating book about the health benefits, believe it or not, that come from orgasms and sex. Interestingly enough, for instance, just taking on seminal fluid for a woman reduces the probabilities of breast cancer. I think it's like twice a week, reduces the probabilities of breast cancer by like 50%. I mean, it's pretty incredible. Reduces hypertension, potential heart attack by a huge number. So it's, you know, it's things that we typically don't think about, but it really has a lot to do with how we were made to function. Now, a lot of times, what begins to feel good to us and what we're comfortable with has a lot to do with how we were first involved sexually. And I call it patterning, that there's almost an imprinting that occurs. And so you know, as long as, first off, I wouldn't say that it's bad, and I wouldn't go judging yourself and putting any pressure on yourself. I think that you need to accept yourself as you are and just revel in that. It's an incredible blessing. So don't think that there's something wrong with you if you can only have one type of orgasm. You know, you're probably in the boat with about 70% of other women, if I remember the statistics right. So that's not strange. I mean, many, many, many women, if they can be orgasmic, can only be orgasmic literally and not vaginally, even though there are some who can do that. And women who can orgasm with their eyes open, that's a whole other type of orgasm. I mean, or a different type of experience. Only 15% of women can actually orgasm with their eyes open. So it's a complicated thing. And the question about release, I think, is a great question. I think it comes a lot to being able to let go and also just kind of understanding and being well-educated. And I think for many people, you know, we really haven't, especially Christians, we really haven't looked at this thing a whole lot. And the whole sexual thing has kind of been somewhat taboo. But in reality, we ought to own this particular part. I mean, it's about something magnificent. I think it has a lot to do with how we're created in the image of God. So I would highly recommend just doing some reading and some education, and don't think that there's anything wrong with how you are. If God grants you the ability to go some other directions, that's great, but I wouldn't make orgasms, ever make orgasms the goal. Love is always the goal. Orgasms are byproduct. It's really about loving another person and connecting with another person. Anytime you begin to make the orgasm the goal, ultimately what you'll do is get into spectator and performance orientation, and the other person begins to go to the wayside, and that's not what you want.
Can I read the next question? This is good stuff. So, Rick, my husband and I are 8 months out from discovery. We attended EMS earlier this year. Sometimes I think we are making progress, and I am beginning to handle his infidelity better. But lately, I seem to be losing ground for some reason. I know you said that that can happen around a year from discovery, but what could be happening to me now? I seem to be even more angry with him than I was for the first few months. During those months, I cried all the time. Is this just another phase in the healing that I must go through?
And I would say yes. A lot of times the anger stage comes farther in the process. And in my opinion, the reason that occurs is when you begin to feel safer in the relationship and more secure, then somehow it feels there's more of an ability, I think, to be expressive and to deal with the part that's angry about what happened. And in the initial stage, when there's the ambivalence and you don't know whether or not, you know, if the relationship is solid, a lot of people are very afraid to really express anger for fear that they'll push the relationship away. So typically, if I see somebody between like 6 and 9 months start getting really angry, I always view that as a really good sign, because it means that the relationship has been healing and now it's become safe enough for that kind of part of you to be able to express itself.
Okay. The next comes from the same person. Rick, during the many, many years of my husband's emotional affair, he treated me pretty badly. He seemed to have no feelings for me and pretended he was always just tired when he acted so negative or uninterested in me and the kids. He criticized me regularly, as well as the children, and always took everything we did or said in the worst possible way. Whatever I would say to him, he would interpret in the worst possible way and answer in a very hateful, defensive voice or start ranting. Even when I would start to talk, he would assume that he knew what I was going to say, jump to that conclusion, and react the same way. Our local counselor said he had to make me out to be the bad guy in our marriage so he could justify his affair. My question is, why is he still doing this? He still jumps to conclusions about whatever I say and reacts very negatively and harshly. If I point out to him what I was really saying or meant to say, if he would let me finish, then he'll apologize in a very non-sorry manner,
But the next time, he does the very same thing. How can I get him to start thinking positively about me and giving me the benefit of the doubt that he would naturally give anyone else who spoke with him? He says he's trying, but it doesn't seem that way to me. I get very discouraged about his feelings for me and the marriage when he continues to treat me this way.
So, you know, one thing I would ask, since I know on the No Forward Progress and the anger looks like this is submitted by the same person, and certainly not saying you're the problem, but one of the things you might want to look at your own heart, you know, is for the way he treated you in the beginning, have you been able to forgive him for that? Because it sounds like that was pretty bad. And your local counselor is right. I mean, one of his defense mechanisms, I'm sure, was to see you a certain way. The problem that begins to occur is that lens takes a long time. Once we begin to see someone negatively, it actually takes 5 times longer for something to move to the positive than it does for something to move to the negative. We go negative very rapidly. It's a slow process to go the other way. And I would say that, you know, it's going to be really useful for the two of you to be in marriage therapy where someone can actually help you learn to see each other differently. Both of you kind of doing exercises about, just telling each other things you appreciate about the other person, so where you have to begin to flip that lens around. And those are the types of rituals that begin to make a significant difference. Being able to each agree that in the morning before you leave and at night, you know, when you come home and at night when you go to bed, you each have to tell the other person something you appreciate. That kind of thinking slowly kind of causes you to look through the different lens. And once that, you know, he's already been in that negative lens for so long, I would just say that if he's being truthful and his heart is to change, but it's just difficult, then that would be a great exercise to begin to make that occur.
Next?
Yep.
So the next one is two-part, and it's quite long. Healthy and reasonable boundaries. And this is from this couple.
Okay.
Well, my husband has made the choice to commit to our marriage. We live overseas and are back after a few months of being away from the place where the affair happened and the discovery. Now that we are here, what are some reasonable boundaries to enforce, keeping me feeling safe and him on the right track? I know I can't follow him everywhere like a puppy dog, but in the past, he would tell me he was going to hang out with friends from work and would actually go and see his affair partner. We only have one car, and I suggested that he have a friend I trust take him to and from any outings he may want to go on, but I can't enforce this. I would have to literally go downstairs from our apartment each time he got home to check if the person who said was driving him really was driving him home. Is this reasonable, at least for now? Do you have any suggestions on how to allow him some freedom to hang out with his friends and make me feel safe at the same time? Thankfully, his AP isn't at work anymore due to other issues from the affair, but we still don't know in which town she's living. He says he hasn't contacted her, and I believe him. At times, especially living back here, I'm very insecure and want to check his email account and phone. Should I come to him and ask him to show me stuff or just sneak around and check? I haven't looked at any of them and feel a bit weird asking him. He's told me he's very willing to do what it takes to make me feel safe here. I'm just having a very hard time coming up with practical ways for him to do that. I've never had to worry about him doing anything other than what he said until now. And I don't know how to go about checking on things and making sure he isn't doing anything he shouldn't. I know I can't be God on his shoulder, but I don't want to be naive anymore either. Please help. Update on the question. Since writing this question, I found out that he contacted her by text. I was very upset and angry. He broke his trust with me, and it is so hard to figure out what to do next. I have been given his phone number wherever he goes out, and her number was once more erased from his phone. Is this just a relapse that I should have expected, or is it something to worry about a lot? I have a friend who told me I should pack up and move home. We are living overseas at the moment. If a relapse in a Lindgren's affair is normal, I think packing up and moving is a little too much too soon, but we are only in the new country for 5 days before he contacted a friend for his AP's number and then began texting her to find out about the child. But there are emotion sends as well from him and consequently from her with lots of kissy faces between them. He said he was sorry, but his body language said otherwise. He is even beginning to think our EMS weekend counseling and weekly calls are making things worse. Is it just ambivalence? Is this a sign of his grieving? He still says he wants us to give it a try, at least for the kids. He says that he won't even be happy with her right now, wondering if we really do have something good and he didn't try to work for it. I'm very torn and hurting. Help.
So,
practical measures and what to do with it.
If you remember from the EMS weekend, I spoke some about relapse and said that, you know, most people, when they first go into recovery, will say they're willing to do whatever it takes and are serious as a heart attack when that occurs. But even when we're serious as a heart attack, there's still always two sides to us. I mean, you know, from a spiritual perspective, we say we're flesh and we're spirit. And at one level, those two natures always kind of war against each other. And even if someone's determined, I think, to break off an affair and they're serious, you've always got to remember that 53% that wants to do that still has 47% underneath that doesn't want to have to do that and is upset about doing that. That's just our nature as human beings. There's always a push-pull that we experience. And in that one particular lecture, you might want to go back, and if you still got the CD we handed out at the end of the weekend, when someone relapses, which is a natural part of change, they will move to one of three places. They're either going to go back to what we call pre-contemplative, where they don't think there's anything wrong with what they're doing. They'll go back to ambivalence, or the contemplative stage, which is about, yeah, maybe I should change, maybe I shouldn't, don't know what I really want to do, I'm kind of stuck. Or they go back to the determination stage and kind of increase what is going to be necessary for the change to ultimately occur. In other words, even though initially people really aren't willing to do whatever it takes, what research shows is that after multiple relapses, they eventually get to the place where they are finally willing to do what's going to be necessary. It's just that there's almost like they have to fail multiple times before they get to that place of acceptance of what it really is. So if someone is ambivalent, however, and they don't go, they're not fully determined, they're kind of, you know, I know what I really want to do and what I need to do, but this is really hard, and, you know, you need to do this, and, you know, it's whatever. I think you give them a season. You set a date, because relapse is very normal. I mean, how we respond to the relapse is what's important. Again, are they very soft? Are they trying? Are they independent? Are they trying to change direction? Are they trying to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did this. You know, I feel terrible about what I did to you. Because remember, godly sorrow is far more about grieving over what your actions have cost your mate, and grieving over what your actions have cost God, rather than just kind of worrying about ultimately what your actions may have cost you. And, you know, if that kind of continues over time, and you set a date, like let's say, I'm not saying this is the date, but let's say you say, okay, I'm going to wait to the end of the year and we'll see what happens. But if there's not that, you know, the effort necessary to kind of break off, if he's not taking responsibility for it, it's not safe, and I'm going to go ahead and go home. And in the meantime, you know, I would try to love him well. I mean, just tell him every day, you know, there's nothing you're ever going to do to get me to quit loving you. And when you leave, you know, if he were not to turn, you would say, you know, there's nothing you're ever going to do to get me to quit loving you, which is why I'm leaving you. Because, you know what, it's not loving of me to let you stay in this sort of destructive pattern. You don't know what you want. And obviously, I'm the only one here who really wants to be healthy, so I'm moving on. So, I mean, that may be a hard thing to say, but I think it may take something like that. You're kind of taking care of yourself before, you know, he begins to kind of look at what's really important to him. And so, again, I would set that date somewhere out there in the future and then decide what you want.
Healing without brokenness. And this is from yesterday. My husband tells me he is sorry about the affair, sorry that he even met the other woman, sorry he broke his vows, hurt me, and so on. But it's still very defensive whenever we talk about it. He was a long-time emotional affair with a woman in our church where they were somewhat physical, but he says they never had actual sex, although she offered it. She and her husband subsequently moved out of town for work. Only our adult children and one other friend couple knows about the affair. My husband was a longtime staff member in our church and gave his, quote, retirement notice after discovery, but has not disclosed any of this to anyone at the church who, by the way, think he is a perfect, wonderful servant of the Lord. Do you think because he is keeping his reputation or image intact and can continue to pretend that he is who all these other people think he is, that could be part of the reason he doesn't seem broken by his actions? Our local counselor, whom he refuses to see anymore, said he must be broken about his actions in order for healing to begin. Our children, all sons, also don't believe he's truly remorseful for what he has done because they don't see brokenness. Sometimes I think he should tell at least the elders of the church, but then I wonder if that could be vindictiveness on my part. Will he be able to truly repent and work on healing for himself and for me as long as he is keeping up this pretense? He also comes across like he still doesn't think what they did was so bad and admits he never thought about it as an affair and still has trouble thinking of it that way. He will say, I guess it was an affair since you and Rick say it was. Could that thought process also be part of the issue?
Absolutely. That thought process could be part of the issue, but it's really kind of more of an issue of the heart. I mean, it's difficult to let go of a limit relationship, and the image management thing doesn't work well. It's really not, I don't know, to me so much of it is about acceptance, kind of like looking at myself, not blaming other people, just looking at myself and saying, wow, you know, that's amazing, where I can be honest with who I am. That's a difficult process. And unless he's with other people who are helping him with that, I think it's going to be incredibly difficult. I would hope at some point, because telling the elders, that's not ultimately what's going to do it. I think being involved in groups with other men who are broken, such as Sober Recovery, AA, NA, any sort of group like that would probably be very helpful because what it does is it begins to detoxify the shame. And I think it allows you to kind of see it from a different perspective. You know, you have to be able to get over kind of your own entitlement and your own rights and, again, begin to consider what you've done to other people in the long run. Be able to be honest with yourself about how you really are and your own deception and what you've really done. If you continue to use defense mechanisms, it's really hard to get very far in recovery. I think we have to begin to work at accepting that, you know, we're not a great deal for God, and there's certainly no reason to pretend that we're a great deal. In that process, you know, I would hope at some point that he's talking to somebody that can just help him, because trying to go this one alone is very, very difficult. And, you know, until he's detached from the other person and kind of broken, there will be that kind of critical spirit, in a sense, just because it's the only way to be able to justify kind of what's happening in him. So it's very difficult to heal without brokenness. I just hope that somehow he's able to, again, to get to the place where he can be some other people and be honest and open.
Okay, next one is again from this couple.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband has been in a limerence affair lasting about a year and is choosing to work on the marriage. He's gone through 90 days with no contact but still has very strong feelings for his AP and has a hard time with good feelings and emotions for me. How can I respond to him when he feels he is in love with this person but doesn't think he loves me or has loved me through our 14 years of being together? What can I do to help him through this time of letting his AP go, but not totally wanting to in his emotions? Because of circumstances, we will have to be in contact with her in the near future and possibly the rest of our lives. I am very concerned that seeing her will spark his feelings even stronger when he can't say that he even loves me. He's choosing to stay with the marriage, but wonders how we can be happy together. He has felt at times, and maybe still does, that she's his soulmate, and maybe I am the limerence object, or I was. I want to help him through this, but I don't know what to say or do or how to react to his bad days. He doesn't share all his feelings with me because he says they will hurt me too much if I know them, but I'm more afraid of him keeping them inside. Help.
You know, I think that the couples that I see that do well in breaking out from limerence affairs, one of the things that's important is being able to process kind of the feelings and talk about it. And I know that it may be painful, but, you know, protecting you in a sense from kind of what he's experiencing and thinking that he's got to control your emotions is sort of codependent in some way. You know, I really encourage couples, if they can have that rational conversation about what those feelings are, if they can view it and be honest about it and accept it and kind of work around it, and if you cannot, you know, kind of totally lose it, but just be interested in knowing what happens in that part of him. Because if someone's willing to share that, it's not that they're rejecting you. In fact, the fact that they're exposing it to the light means that they're really choosing you. So, you know, to me, what would be the good sign would be his willingness to share kind of the struggles. And what would be really healthy to me would be maybe your ability to rationally look at that with him and not take that on as a rejection of you, but understand it's about an addiction and it's not about you. And that's a very difficult place and it takes a lot of maturity, but I would hope that the two of you could come to that place.
The next one is dealing, and it is from the wife and the couple.
Okay.
I have to see my husband's affair partner every once in a while at church, where her family and I still worship. I really am working on forgiving her and letting it go. However, sometimes when I see her, I still get anxious and want to throw up. Is there a way to deal with feeling like I have to avoid her and getting past the anxiety?
I'm reading this again. You know, the one thing I would say, this is really hard, and when I've got someone that has wounded me or as I see really as a threat, I always am just praying that God will bless them, and just I keep praying and interceding and saying, you know, God, please forgive them. They really don't know what they're doing. They don't understand. Because I just know that when I can begin to wish well for them instead of the part of me that wants to be vengeful, that ultimately sets me free. So, believe it or not, I would start by praying for her and, you know, I don't know if there's any benefit in ultimately talking with her. But I would for sure begin by praying for her and just asking God. And that doesn't mean you have to reconcile with her. I remember Luke 17. There's the vertical and horizontal forgiveness. Horizontal is more about reconciliation. The vertical is between you and God. You know, I just want to release her so it doesn't make me sick. And right now, you know, it's kind of making me sick. You know, because like bitterness, we say, or that resentment, it's the unforgiveness, or it's the poison that we ultimately drink in an attempt to kill another person. And that just doesn't work too good.
Separation at this point. And that's 9 months have passed since discovery day, and my husband has not come back to the house. I spoke to him to see if the reason was because he still loves the affair partner. He said that he just doesn't know why he can't come back. Also, he mentioned that he remembers discovery day and cannot forget how he hurt me. He constantly tells me that he loves me, misses me, and wants to be with me. That hurts me even more because I see no action following those words. Sometimes I wonder if it's better for him to be away than to have him in the house disconnected from the situation. His priorities are other things, like work. At this point, my family and friends are asking if something is wrong. I can't seem to understand what God wants me to do. I just feel that I need to separate from him and make it official. Is it too early in the process to decide this?
No, because something's wrong. I think that it's interesting because he said that he doesn't know why he can't come back. Also, he mentioned that he remembers Discovery Day and cannot forget how he hurt me. He constantly tells me that he loves me, misses me, wants to be with me. That hurts me even more. But, you know, it's like he's kind of choosing to focus a little bit on well, it sounds a little bit like excuses to me to some extent, only in the sense that he's hurting me by what he's doing right now and still feels it's a little bit about him and what's convenient for him. And it is uncomfortable. And I do think that if you've given him 9 months to be able to make some sort of move, that's pretty generous, but at some point, I don't know that it's going to be healthy for him for you to continue in that pattern, and so maybe you need to consider, because this isn't working, what you're doing right now, and I'd be prayerful about what do we need to do different to make things begin to change, because you do not want to stay caught in this pattern.
Okay, the next one is from this couple, and they also emailed us earlier in the week. Did you see that email?
Mm-hmm.
I pulled it up too. Rick, we have just completed your latest EMS. As part of that, you recommend that my husband and myself together call the affair partner and tell her not to call. If she does, he will immediately call me and will forward any future texts and emails. Since home, he has resisted this event happening, wanting to wait. Questions are, when do you recommend this takes place? Since she lives a block from us, should I push to move? That will be bad. We love our home. How do you recommend that we handle the new person at work that he is infatuated with? What steps should he take since he works with her? What should I do about him resisting wearing his wedding band? Should I force it or wait until he's ready? And finally, he keeps asking me how I got my information, accusing me of phone taps and computer hacking, both not true. What should I do? I have said it doesn't matter how I became suspicious, considering I was right.
Okay, so...
Did you get the email?
Yeah.
Okay.
First off, one of the things that I believe that was suggested for y'all is that there be some counseling, and I would actually start at that place and not worry so much about let the counselor determine when that needs to happen. And I would feel very comfortable with that. So I would start, take that into the counselor, leave it with them, and kind of let somehow that occur as it needs to occur. It may be, since I know this case specifically, that the three of us could also talk, but I still think your counselor or his new counselor ought to be involved. And I think his new counselor should be involved in that situation also. In terms of the wedding ban, if there's a part of him that's resisting that at this point, I think that not forcing is probably a really good thing. I really want people to come back into a relationship kind of out of a heart's draw, kind of from the heart, rather than trying to fake it till you make it. Because I think that if we just try to fake it in the long run, our flesh kind of runs out. And so counseling, let the counselor kind of then determine and give you direction, give him direction on how to handle both of those things. And now, if he's not willing to go to the counseling, then that's a whole other issue, but I believe he probably is. In terms of asking me how you got the information, I don't know that it's really wise for either of you to kind of hold information back. I'd recommend you both work at being honest with each other, and because I really do believe that the quickest way to gain trust is to trust the other person with information, and if we won't do that, then it does make it far more difficult. So I would be honest with him and tell him you hope that in return he can be honest with you. He's not going to be happy, and it's not going to, and maybe you're worried that you won't be able to find information in the future at the same time. I would say that I think, you know, God has more than an ability to let you know what's going on. Okay.
Well, last one. We have just completed the latest EMS weekend, which was so helpful, and I felt tremendously encouraged. Although I've never once thought of anything except reconciliation, this last week I've begun to question whether that was the best course of action. I don't understand this and wondered if it's typical of my roller coaster emotions or just what's happening. My husband is anxious to move back home, although I'm praying I don't understand. Can you help?
You bet. So, again, it's real easy for us to want what we don't have. And a lot of times people get very, very focused on, you know, getting out of the crisis and somehow saving the marriage. They don't really ask all of the questions. Is this really what I want? And they don't even allow themselves to really have all the feelings because it's really right now survival. It's really trying not to drown in what seems like an incredible morass, just a horrible situation. Suddenly, when it shifts and now the other person, instead of pulling away, wants to come back, that desire to do things, you know, wanting what I don't have, goes away, and now I ask, is this really what I want? Most people at the point of crisis aren't asking if this is really what I want. They just don't want to lose what they have. Hopefully that made sense. I think you know your heart. I'm sure that it's probably, given the amount of pain that you've gone through, very scary. But at the same time, it's a matter of being willing to give up control. I think a lot of times we try to hang on to control in order to kind of keep ourselves safe. But if you see a repentant heart, then, you know, my question would be, why wouldn't you want to go ahead and begin that reconciliation process to see ultimately what will happen? And I would just look at your heart and say, really, what do I want? And if the answer is, what's God telling me? If God's telling you it does not need to make sense to you, just go ahead and walk that walk. If you doubt whether what you're hearing is really God, then check it out with other people spiritually that you have a lot of trust in and faith in, and see if they can confirm one way or the other kind of what you're hearing. So, any more questions? That's it for the day. Thank you very much, everybody. Those were great questions. And I will be gone for the next two Mondays, so there will be no Q&A call until after
Labor Day.
So you guys have a good 3 weeks, and get those questions up, and we'll get on them week after next. So long, guys. Bye-bye. God bless.